the reproductive survey and the aging of the animals. But there are some definitely similarities between the populations in Russia and the United States and Canada. And I guess the greatest similarity would be that the population does cycle in the sense of being a very high population and then reverting to a low population on a period of about 3 to 4 years on the average. And when I got to Russia, I was hoping to collect about 100 fox carcasses for the surveys that we're doing. And unfortunately, I was there during a low population year, so I was only able to get about 33 specimens. So there's not a great deal one can do with 33 in comparison to the close to 600 that I have here from the Barrow area of Alaska. But it, I think if I had to pick just 1 year to go over there and collect, being there at a low year was probably the best time, because that's the point in the population cycle where we have the least amount of information on the disease status and so on of these animals. I'd like to mention that the disease work that we're doing is in cooperation with Don Ritter of the Virology Rabies Unit here of the Alaska Health Department. And he's a significant co-principal investigator on this project. Unfortunately, he was not able to get over to Russia with us last spring because of other commitments. But so at this point, we we're in the process of looking at some of the data has been worked up. We did find some rabid animals from that collection, and some that also had distemper and evidences of some other diseases. The diseases, yes, they are, definitely. Some work that was done by Bob Rausch back some years ago here at the Fairbanks campus suggested that rabies, for example, is one of the more significant mortality factors for not only foxes but other canids in Alaska. So it is a quite significant thing. And it seems the breakouts of this disease seems to occur principally when the population is crashing. This crash occurs as a result of a reduced food supply, mostly mice and lemmings and things like this. When their population declines, the fox population has already built up to a high level because of this abundant food. Suddenly, when the food supply then bottoms out, the fox population is faced with a low food availability situation. And then many of them presumably starve, and there's a lot of movement of animals in search of food sources. And it's during these times that presumably they become more susceptible to diseases like rabies. And you can have a high percentage of the population then that succumbs to that disease. As far as we know, it is fatal in foxes, as it would be in other canids. But I think there's even perhaps some question there. And there needs to be considerable amount of work done in this area. Well, I hate to throw out some figures, but because the figures are biased, but over the past 10 years, Don's figures, based on animal heads that were sent to his laboratory for analysis because the animals were suspicious, acting behaviorally, attacking school buses or whatever, that in some cases over 40% of the animals were rabid. And I think in last winter it was as high as 70%, which is exceedingly high. But as I mentioned, the conditions of collection were biased, because the animals that were sent in were ones that appeared abnormal. And you have abnormal behavior associated with the clinical phase of rabies. The animals, are attacking, inanimate objects or people or buses. They're occurring in town, and when knowledge of rabies gets out, an animal is sent in and it's rabid from a certain area like Barrow, then suddenly the people are alerted, and then if they see a fox in town, they'll probably kill it and send the head in for analysis. So the population that we're sampling over the past 6 years, these are animals that are collected from trappers. So presumably we've eliminated that bias. They're not animals that necessarily act abnormally at all. So we should get a better handle on what the incidence of these diseases is in a natural population. And that's what we're trying to do with the study, is try to refine exactly what happens to the percentage of occurrence of these diseases during this population cycle. You know, just from past evidence, we would anticipate that animals during a crash, you would find a higher percentage, let's say rabid, whereas the following winter after the crash, when the population is low, we would find a very low incidence. It's interesting, though, that with this Russian sample, that we did find several animals out of only 33 that were had indications of rabies.
Now, would that be, when we talk about biases, could that be a bias in that the animal that's rabid is more likely to be caught?
Well, that's a question I I have myself. An animal that's rabid or showing clinical signs of rabies, which is, you know, sort of toward the end there, is not eating, essentially. I think, you know, the central nervous system is so messed up that the animal is going through all kinds of abnormal contortions and so on. And and all the trappers up there use bait. They're not like the old dry sets that we use back in the Midwest for foxes. And so in that sense, I'm not sure. It could be we're biased against getting a rabid animal because they may not be attracted to a bait, because maybe there's problems with the olfaction, the smelling of these, you know, the scents that would emanate from a bait or whatever. So this is one thing that I'm not quite sure of and could affect the, you know, end results of our study. And so I'm not, can't really answer that for sure. We may be going the other route, you know, and going to the other extreme, rather than getting a good fair bias, a good fair sample. But we would be able to find evidence of rabies prior to an animal becoming clinically, you know, rabid, in the sense of the abnormal behaviors and so on. And so hopefully we'll be able to pick those up, and presumably at that time yet the animals would be going through their normal routine of, you know, searching out food sources and so on. So. The results that we do have back at to date are really the ones that relate to the disease. I'm just looking over the data here now. Of the 33 animals, we had two that were positive for rabies. And we've had none with distemper and none with hepatitis. But there are some other indications in about 10 animals that there was some indication of some previous, like an encephalitis of some sort. And so that's the only, you know, hard thing that we have to date. I just got the teeth samples back a couple of weeks ago from the laboratory that sections them, there we do the age analysis. And I haven't had a chance to look at those yet. The males, none of them were reproductively active during this period of February and early March that I was there. And this was would be expected. The animals, they breed in usually March, well, in April, and have their young then usually in June. So it's through the winter that the gonads begin developing again for the upcoming reproductive season. So the samples I actually had, some were collected in December prior to my arrival, and the rest of them were from February. And so during this period, I would not expect, you know, to get that result. I have not in detail looked at the female reproductive tracts, but there were indications on at least two animals of past reproductive success in the sense of having scars in the uterus, which would represent an implantation site from a previous pregnancy. And so I have a couple of those I know in there, but I haven't actually gone to them and counted the number of scars, nor looked at the ovaries yet for analysis of the number of corpoluteia that would be present there, indicating an ovulation. None. I firmly feel that because of the circumpolar distribution of the Arctic fox, that we're going to find very little difference in things like disease and reproduction between them. The reason I say this is that having lived in Barrow for 2 years and talking to other people who have lived there and other villages like Kaktovik and Prudhoe Bay, for example. In fall, like October, November, you have a surge of animals congregating on the coast, and trapping during that period is quite good. And these animals presumably come off the tundra and come to the coast, and then when the pack ice forms, so there's a continuous ice from the shore, many of them move out onto the ice. And so from, let's say, mid-November until early February, you don't see many foxes around. And then suddenly, February, March, there's a big surge again. And presumably these animals are coming off the ice back to the tundra to establish their territories and eventual breeding. And when they're out on the ice, they're following, you know, polar bears and so on, and scavenging on wastes out there. And we know that we have this significant ice movement out there called the Beaufort Sea Gyre, which is a clockwise turning of the pack ice. Now, if foxes get out onto this area, and they've been recorded, you know, within 100 kilometers of the North Pole, if they get out on this ice, it's always moving toward the west. So if they're out there for a period of 3 to 4 months, and have, let's say, have gone off at Point Barrow, it could very well be, based on the speed of the ice, that when they do come back south toward a terrestrial environment to breed, that they're in Russia. So I think there's a significant mixing of animals from the various continents. I think because of this, we're not going to find that many differences in terms of some of these things like rabies and other diseases and reproductive effort. So I think it's just the nature of the environment up there and the fact that they do have these consistent movements year after year.
Will your research be able to substantiate some of that field?
Not really. We don't have enough samples from Russia to really say much about that. And if I were able to get back there, let's say over a period of 4 to 5 years, or get tissues from the animals, then we might be able to do some comparative work. But the animals over there are somewhat different behaviorally also. The Russians have long reported, you know, since the 50s, mass migrations of foxes from the north coast down into the more central parts of Siberia. And these presumably are principally a result of a reduced food supply in the area where the animals had spent the summer. And they have these mass migrations to the south. Alaska doesn't, or that hasn't really been reported for Alaska. In Canada, there have been a couple of fairly recent reports, like in Manitoba, where Arctic fox migration has been documented. But it doesn't appear to be something that we face here in Alaska.
Could it be because of the difference in terrain where we have mountain barriers?
I think that's quite possible, yeah. My experience is up there in Russia, most of the big rivers in that area all flow north into the Arctic Ocean, whereas many of ours, you know, flow to the south. And so I think there could very well be some of these geographical barriers that may be allowing this to occur more readily in Siberia and not here in Alaska. It doesn't explain the situation in Canada, though, because the Brooks Range essentially peters out as you get past our border with Canada, and from that point on, it's relatively flat country, so one would expect maybe to see it there, too. It could be. We just haven't done enough work on the fox in terms of this behavior to determine that it really occurs there more consistently.
Okay, on the fox, you said that the Canadian... You'd expect similar to the Russian experience there.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think the possibility exists because terrain-wise there are some similarities. But there are some distinctions, at least in some of the research that's been done in reproduction on the Canadian side versus the Russian, and that's one thing I'm very interested in looking at, the female reproductive tracts from the animals we've collected at Barrow. There are two significantly different views on how the population is regulated in terms of reproduction. The Canadians feel that there is no difference in the number of ovulations that occur in the females and no difference in the number of implantations in the uterus year after year, no matter what stage of the cycle one is facing. whether there's an abundant food supply or a very low food supply. And therefore, the same numbers of young on the average are born each year, again, independent of food supply. But that a population changes based on how much mortality occurs in the pups. If the food supply is very low, there would be a lot of starvation of pups and actually strife between individual pups, some killing others and so on. And this would tend to reduce then the population during these low periods. Whereas when food supply was very high, you would not have this facing and you would then get a very good production of pups. The Russians view it differently. Their research suggests that it's more dependent on the condition of the adults during breeding, in other words, during late winter. They say that when food supply is low, that you have fewer ovulations and fewer implantations in the uterus, and that the postnatal mortality, as it would be called, is less a factor. And whereas when food is abundant and the adult foxes are in good condition during breeding, you have an increased number of ovulations and implantations, and then you have a higher production of pups. So they look at it two different ways, and they're biologically those are significantly different. And so therefore I hope with these, I've got about 600 animals, and roughly half of those will be female, that I'll be able to evaluate this, because I have collected animals in over a what turned out for us a five-year cycle. The low period was in 77, 78, and the high was in 81, 82. And we had then a crash last year. And I collected animals there, too, to build up my sample during that low period. So hopefully the results will shed some light, either corroborating either one of the two positions, or my feeling is it may be, intuitively, I would say it's affecting both, that you will have effects on the reproduction in the female itself and also then on the pups after they're produced. So I hope to get a handle on that aspect, which would be quite interesting.
That's definite. And you'll be able to get at least some indications from the carcasses you have?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've collected the reproductive tracts completely, the ovaries and the uterus, from each of the females. And this is then basically how we go about these types of analyses. And it's just a gross type of anatomical survey, really, that we do. And we should get some handle then on those aspects.
Let me kind of back up, repeat a question I've asked earlier, slightly differently. At this point, what have you discovered that you anticipated or were surprised? What hard data do you have?
None. I just haven't had the funding really in a consistent fashion in order to go ahead with the research. So I can't really say anything at this point in time, as to what's happening. I can say I've aged, at least initially aged about 500 of the samples we've collected, and there is a vast proportion of the animals are young, 1 and 2 years old, which would be expected in a species like this, which in the wild may, on the average, 3 to 4 years would be, quite old on the average. I have a few animals that indicate an age of about 8 or 9 years, but those are quite rare. And you would definitely find changes in the population age structure through the cycle also. Presumably during these low periods following a crash, you would have an abundance of older aged animals. And as the population increased, the increase is really then adding numbers of young to the population. So during these high levels, you'd have a distinctly different age structure in the population than you would during low. And I've aged 500, but I haven't categorized them yet as the year of collection. I've tried to eliminate that bias in my mind when I'm going through the aging process. I'll just age all of them together in a lump, then I'll go back and sort them out by what years they were collected, and then be able to filter out then the information on age structure. No, when I go to Barrow, and then when I went to Siberia, what I do is get the carcasses from the trappers, and then I dissect them there. I cut the heads off, and the head then is used for analysis for rabies, distemper, and we're also looking at them for hepatitis. There are indications that the virus will also occur in the brain tissue, not only in the liver. And then the age, we pull a canine tooth out for the aging process. And then I take out the reproductive tracts of both the males and females, and a chunk of the liver, just, you know, a cubic inch on the average. And we use this then for hepatitis analysis also. So yeah, that would be an enormous burden to bring all those carcasses here to Fairbanks, plus finding a place to store them while here. And so I condensed that considerably by taking just what we need.
But do you have 600 skull heads somewhere?
We did, yeah. Most of those have been processed, all but about 550. And those have all been discarded. And incidentally, we incinerate all this, the tissues that I have, whether, you know, the animal is diseased or not. We use the incinerator over in the Arctic Health Building to eliminate anything that I use, the paper towels and plastic bags and all that, you know, have been in contact with these specimens. It's all, you know, very carefully disposed of.
I've jumped in the restaurant for a second. Jumped around quite a bit. Things I haven't asked that I should have.
I don't think so. I think that pretty much tells the story of the fox up here. They're a very interesting animal, and there's really been very little work done with them. The Russians really have done the majority of it, but their interests are different in a way from ours. I'm interested. I work with foxes since about 18 years now, starting back in Illinois with the gray and red fox. And I've always been interested in those organisms, and I think they're quite interesting biologically. They're so different in many ways from the, let's say, the red and the gray. The gray, you know, well, doesn't hardly occur even in Canada. It's a more southern species, but the red fox does coexist with the Arctic in certain areas on the slope. They're adjoining areas. And but the Arctic fox is really one that whose behavior changes on an annual basis. It's red foxes tend to be somewhat territorial year-round, and gray foxes also, whereas the Arctic fox is territorial during the breeding period from, you know, about March, April through August. They establish territories and are quite concerned about other animals coming into these areas, and they will fend them off. Whereas in the winter, you know, as soon as the young leave the family unit, so to speak, in late summer, early fall, the Arctic fox then begins to roam around looking for food and so on, and they become not necessarily social, but their tolerance for each other increases. And this is why we find in the winter up there, you know, a beached whale carcass, let's say, from as a result of the subsistence hunt at Barrow or some of the other villages, or one stuck in the ice or a walrus carcass. You can have many, many foxes, up to 30, 40 foxes congregating around one carcass. And I think this is an adaptation to the northern environment, where during this severe winter weather, there is really a low food supply available for them. And the tolerance really allows them then to come together and communally, essentially, feed on this carcass. Whereas an animal that would be territorial year-round, would not be allowed, essentially. They would tend, wherever, if that carcass was located in, let's say, a red fox territory, well, typically the other animals then would not have access to it. So it's a wholly different structure, and it's one that seems very keenly adapted and tuned to this northern environment that they're living in.